much. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Carla Wills, Tammy Warnoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Ravi Karen, Honey Masood, and Adriano Contreras. Our general manager is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Miriam Barnard, Dennis Moynihan, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grand. Stay safe. Save lives, wear a mask, and go to our website at democracynow.org for our coverage of the Gulf Coast, for our coverage of the conventions, for our coverage of global issues and the issue of police brutality and the climate crisis.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the U.S. attorney intends to bring charges against 74 individuals involved in the protests at the federal courthouse. Mayor Wheeler says he has a plan to revitalize downtown Portland. And in national news, thousands attended today's Get Your Knees Off Our Necks march in Washington, D.C. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, August 28th, 2020. I'm Nat Moon. Yesterday, the U.S. Attorney for Oregon announced that 74 people are facing federal charges associated with the protests in downtown Portland over the last 3 months. The nationwide protests started in response to the murder of George Floyd by Minneapolis police in late May. In July, federal agents were sent by Acting Department of Homeland Security Secretary Chad Wolf. Their arrival prompted a resurgence in protests, resulting in many nights of police violence against demonstrators in front of the federal courthouse downtown. U.S. Attorney Billy Williams said that Portland had been gripped by nightly protests since the killing of George Floyd and that, quote, violent agitators have hijacked any semblance of First Amendment protected activity. Charges include failing to obey a lawful order, damaging government property, arson, and assaulting a federal officer. So far, no charges have been levied on federal officers responsible for assaulting journalists, medics, and legal observers. The announcement of charges and Williams's comments come the day after the American Civil Liberties Union filed a suit stating that federal agents used excessive force and illegal detentions to rob the protesters of their freedom of speech and right to assembly. The suit also states that acting DHS Director Wolf did not have the authority to send more than 100 agents to Portland because he was improperly appointed. ACLU attorney Jeremy Sachs said that protesters were, quote, met by violence from the federal police forces intent on squelching the protesters' message and their constitutional rights and in aid of the president's political agenda. Yesterday marked the 91st straight day of protest in Portland, but unlike many previous nights, the Portland police remained peaceful. Demonstrators with the Portland Black Youth Movement gathered in Dunaway Park to show support for Jacob Blake and other Black people who have suffered at the hands of police violence. Blake, the father of three children aged 3 through 8, was shot in the back 7 times by a Kenosha, Wisconsin police officer last Sunday. The protesters left the park at 7:30 and marched to downtown Portland. Supporters along the way encouraged them and praised their efforts. The marchers returned to Dunaway Park at about 9:30 and peacefully dispersed. A multi-million dollar state fund to support Black Oregonians and their businesses has received nearly 7,000 applications since its launch on Monday. The $62 million Oregon Cares Fund for Black Relief and Resiliency will provide grants ranging from $500 to $3,000 for Black individuals and families, and grants of $2,000 to $100,000 for Black businesses and Black-led nonprofits. The fund is guided by the Council of Trust, a newly established group of 11 Black leaders from across the state. It is administered by 2 nonprofits, the Contingent and the Black United Fund. Citing Oregon's history of ignoring Black communities, Council Member Sharon Gary Smith told Oregon Live that, quote, this is a major effort for a specific time during a pandemic to provide investment in people to be whole in this moment. As of Thursday evening, 6,672 individuals and families, 201 businesses, and 43 nonprofits had submitted online applications to the fund. The Oregon Cares Fund will choose its recipients through a review and verification process, with final decisions approved by the Council of Trust. In July, the Oregon Legislature's Emergency Board voted to allocate federal CARES Act dollars to seed the fund, despite warnings from the Legislative Council that the decision may be unconstitutional. Though some of the critics of the fund have called it subjective, organizers are hoping to avoid the pitfalls and confusion an earlier Oregon relief program encountered. That program was also established by the Emergency Board. It allocated $35 million to pay people still waiting on unemployment benefits and was fully depleted in under 3 days. Individual temporary relief payments of $500 were distributed in a chaotic scene with individuals receiving the money on a first-come, first-served basis. Those $500 payments were equally distributed to about 70,000 Oregonians. The total number of CARES Fund recipients will depend on the individual grant sizes. Fund organizers are hiring staff with intent to provide outreach in communities throughout the state. An emphasis has been placed to assist individuals and businesses that may not have reliable access to the internet, making sure they are aware of the fund. Council of Trust member Representative Akasha Lawrence Spence said, quote, this is really about reaching Black Oregonians in every corner of the state, and this process is as equitable as possible and really need-based. Yesterday, Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler announced his intention to draft a plan to ensure the recovery of the downtown area. The response was seen as a reaction to an increasing outcry from residents and business leaders who have demanded action. Last week, developer Gary Goodman blasted the mayor and city council in a letter regarding the number of businesses that were leaving downtown. He pointed to boarded up windows, uncollected trash and litter, and a dramatic increase in houselessness as major problems that were not being addressed. Goodman pointed out that many small businesses were struggling to survive and that larger employers who had temporarily relocated employees from downtown offices may choose not to come back unless the situation changes. In yesterday's response, Wheeler promised to make Portland's downtown a better place to live, work, and visit. The mayor promised to work with businesses on repairs so that they can reopen safely and to provide resources to clean up graffiti, clean up the parks, and reduce litter. The mayor defended the city's efforts to counter the COVID-19 pandemic and claimed that Portland was one of the first cities to take aggressive action. He said that an 80-person task force was already in place to support small businesses, especially those owned by Black, Indigenous, or people of color. Wheeler also claimed that the pandemic response had prioritized support of the houseless, but critics point out that much of downtown and surrounding neighborhoods have a larger houseless population than ever before. In a response, Wheeler said, quote, "We are working with urgency to add hundreds of new indoor and outdoor shelter beds. I will be seeking funding for this work in the fall budget." With counting for the 2020 U.S. Census ending next month, a local nonprofit is helping make sure that houseless individuals get counted. This spring, the newspaper Street Roots has partnered with the We Count Oregon campaign with the goal of ensuring that all residents are documented for the census. The paper is sold by those affected by houselessness and focuses on the plight of the houseless and other social justice issues. Together, the two organizations set up the Census Assistance Center, which helps the area's houseless complete the questionnaire. The census asks if someone was houseless on April 1st to describe their living conditions and if that person is living outside. If that is the case, they are told to choose the option that says, quote, "I have no address." But despite the U.S. Census Bureau's assurance that all information received remains completely confidential, many in the houseless community regard submitting their personal information to the government with apprehension. Spokespeople for Street Roots maintain the importance of getting counted. An accurate count helps to ensure that adequate funding can be obtained to keep resources like food stamps, housing assistance, and educational programs available to those who most need them. Street Roots vendor and 2020 Census Outreach member James Pops Doobie said, quote, "The census helps with so much. If people don't tell them, we just can't get the help we really could if they just answer a couple of questions." During COVID-19, people coming to Street Roots to fill out the census are assisted by Doobie and his team members asking the questions from an electronic questionnaire, keeping people from sharing contact and germs. For those without internet or phone access, the ability to ask questions and receive help filling out the questionnaire in person is a key component to the success of the nonprofit's efforts. Beginning Friday, the Street Roots Census Outreach team will begin going directly to different houseless camps around town in hopes of reaching as many people as possible. A wildfire in the Mount Hood National Forest prompted the Wasco County Sheriff's Office to issue updated evacuation notices on Thursday evening. The wildfire was estimated to be nearly 3,000 acres when the advance orders were put in place, but by Friday at noon, the blaze had grown to over 4,500 acres, with only 10% contained. The orders are issued at level 1, 2, and 3, translating to the easily understood messages of "get ready," "get set," and "go," respectively. Governor Kate Brown invoked the Emergency Conflagration Act Friday morning, freeing up state and federal resources to help fight the blaze. The most urgent evacuation orders are for the areas east of Bear Springs Ranger Station along Highway 216 through Pine Grove and all of Endersby Road, Lynn's Mill Road, and Kelly Springs Road. Those areas have received Level 3 Go orders. Level 2 Get Set orders are in place for all residences on Smock Road, west of the intersection of Smock Road and Ayers Road, including all residences on Barber Lane and Fallow Road. Areas given Level 1 orders are east of Wapanita Reservation Road intersection to the intersection of the Old Wapanita Road and Kelly Cutoff. This also includes the Juniper Flat and Old Wapanita Road intersection to the East Wapanita Road and Reservation Road intersection. Residents along Highway 216 have been given the Get Ready orders as well. Over 100 homes have already been evacuated, with over 200 more affected by these orders. A Red Cross shelter has been set up at Maupin High School for evacuees, with doors closing at midnight. The sheriff's office said anyone in need should contact the Red Cross at 888-680-1455 for more information. They will continue taking calls after hours. The fire started on August 17th, and officials have stated that it was probably caused by a lightning storm. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Coming up next, at 5:30, it's Counterspin. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sona Lee. Then at 7, The Struggle with Elisa Pariah. Tonight, we can expect a clear evening with an overnight low of 60 degrees. Tomorrow, we'll see a sunny and mild day with temperatures in the mid-70s. On this day in 1963, the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom took place. It concluded with Dr. Martin Luther King's famous I Have a Dream speech. Today's quote is one of the most famous lines from that speech, where Dr. King said, quote, "I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a country where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character." Thousands of people gathered in Washington today for the Get Your Knees Off Our Necks Commitment March. KBOO's Ray Bodwell has the report.
Coming 57 years to the day after Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s famous I Have a Dream speech, thousands of people marched to the Lincoln Memorial today to once again demand justice for Black Americans. Martin Luther King's son evoked the memory of his father and the ongoing struggle in these remarks.
We're taking a step forward on America's rocky but righteous journey towards justice. August 28th is a day to remember the triumphs and tragedies that have taken place in our historic struggle for racial justice. Today, we commemorate the March on Washington to Jobs and Freedom in 1963, where my father declared his dream. But we must never forget the American nightmare of racist violence. We still struggle for justice, demilitarizing the police, dismantling mass incarceration, and declaring and determinedly as we can that Black lives matter. In our struggle for justice, there are no permanent victories. For on this day, 12 years ago, I was honored to address the Democratic National Convention in Denver. Our spirits were soaring as the Democrats nominated Barack Obama, who would go on to become the first African-American president of these United States. But the progress we celebrated then is imperiled yet again. And now we must march to the ballot box and the mailboxes to defend the freedoms that earlier generations worked so hard to win.
Jacob Blake Sr., father of the young Black father shot in the back by Kenosha police officers last weekend, made an impassioned plea for justice.
There are two systems of justice in the United States. There's a white system and there's a Black system. The Black system ain't doing so well. But we're gonna stand up. Every Black person in the United States is gonna stand up. We're tired. I'm tired of looking at cameras and seeing these young Black and brown people suffer.
And the Reverend Al Sharpton attacked administration efforts to limit voting and demanded that the Senate pass the George Floyd Policing and Justice Act.
We must deal with those that want to rob our right to vote. And even though we are here in the midst of a pandemic, we want to come to show with our bodies that enough is enough. we have passed in the House of Representatives, the George Floyd Policing and Justice Act. Now we need to pass that act in the Senate. We need Mitch McConnell and the U.S. Senate to meet on the George Floyd Policing and Justice Act, or we're going to meet you senators at the poll in November 3rd, whether we got the mail in, walk in, ride in, crawl in. We want our bill passed. Demonstration without legislation will not lead to change. We didn't come out and stand in this heat because we didn't have nothing to do. We come to let you know, if we will come out by these numbers in the heat and stand in the heat, that we will stand in the polls all day long.
Speakers throughout the day vowed to peacefully continue their protests until their demands were met. For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
In her speech at the Republican National Convention, South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem endorsed freedom of speech, the right to assemble, and freedom of religion as promised in the U.S. Constitution. But tribal leaders think her claims are absurd. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Republican National Convention ended Thursday night with President Trump delivering a speech accepting the party's nomination for president. The convention this week featured only one tribal leader, Vice President of the Navajo Nation, Myron Leiser, who endorsed Trump. Other vocal Trump supporters were given primetime speaking spots, including South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem, who has a rocky relationship with tribes in her state on issues such as tribal COVID-19 border checkpoints. Her pro-oil development stance and support of riot-boosting laws at one point led to the Oglala Sioux Tribe banning her from the reservation. In Noem's RNC speech, she mentioned the Constitution and the right to speak, assemble, and worship, which Native community leader and advocate Nick Tilson says is absurd.
Her actions as governor and her relationship to Indigenous people couldn't be more different and couldn't be more egregious in her actions in relation to our communities and to our people. And even right now, I mean, myself being an organizer, along with many of the other land defenders, are being over-persecuted by this exact same system because we stood in our right to freedom of assembly, because we stood in our right to worship and to pray in our language and in our culture, in our Black Hills, and we're being over-persecuted for those things.
Tilson, president and CEO of Indian Collective, is facing felony and misdemeanor charges for the July Land Defender action in the Black Hills, calling for treaty rights and land back in the hours leading up to President Trump's visit to Mount Rushmore. As far as relations with state and federal officials, Tilson says Indigenous people need to illuminate their issues and stand up to avoid erasure, adding national conversations need to include Indigenous values. Meanwhile, the Vice President of the Navajo Nation, Myron Leiser's RNC remarks raised eyebrows this week, with some Democrats calling them misleading. Correspondent Matt Laszlo has details from Washington.
The Republican National Convention turns some heads in Indian country.
Yate, I'm Myron Leiser, the Vice President of the Navajo Nation. I give this address from the majestic rock spires of Shiprock, Sebet-Ai, or Rock with Wings, as known by our Diné people.
Even as statistics tell a different story, Leiser contended that President Trump has been great for tribes.
You see, our people have never been invited into the American dream. We, for years, fought congressional battles with past congressmen and senators that were part of a broken system that ignored us. That is, until President Trump took office. President Trump delivered the largest financial funding package ever to Indian country.
Leiser's views are antithetical to those of the first two female Native American women ever elected to Congress. Earlier this month, Democratic Congresswoman Cherise Davids of Kansas told us the opposite of what Leiser told the nation about the Trump administration's response to COVID in Indian country.
The delays last time had a pretty devastating effect. And of course, you know, Deb Haaland and I have both been fighting to make sure that tribes are being allocated funding. And then once the funding is allocated, we got to make sure that we're getting those resources out to them.
Navajo Nation President Jonathan Nez spoke at the Democratic National Convention. For National Native News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
The Southwestern Association for American Indian Arts Indian Market is coming to an end. The month-long virtual market featured arts, culture, film, and fashion. The grand finale this weekend features a concert, native cinema, and conclusion of the virtual 3D Indian world. The fine arts market went online this year due to COVID-19. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Protests in Kenosha, Wisconsin, in response to the police shooting of Jacob Blake, have brought a spotlight onto longstanding racial gaps in the Midwest. Some areas of the Midwest have some of the worst outcomes for Black residents when it comes to economic opportunities and education. Mike Moen has more.
Demands for social justice in cities like Kenosha are linked to racial inequities deeply rooted in the nation's history. But researchers say these gaps are more prominent in Midwestern states like Wisconsin. Many recent protests are sparked by high-profile police shootings, but those cries also point to systemic racism, and recent studies find the Midwest has some of the worst outcomes for Black residents. Laura Dresser of the Center on Wisconsin Strategy says when Blacks fled to these states in the days of slavery, they may have found job stability in some cities, but housing policies pave the road for future problems.
Because of the residential segregation and because of the racism and discrimination in outlying areas, it made moving to where economic opportunity grew much more difficult.
She adds that in struggling urban areas where Black populations were forced to stay, an eroding economic base created a host of barriers that exist today. Dresser contributed to a 2019 report led by the Economic Policy Institute that said all 12 Midwestern states have deep racial disparities in areas from education and jobs to health and home ownership. In these states, Dresser says Black elected leaders have tried calling attention to these issues, but their voices are often drowned out amid decades of growing political divisions. However, she notes if more of these voices can be heard, solutions can be found.
Think about raising the minimum wage or extending Medicaid, which the state of Wisconsin has not done. These two things would make an enormous difference.
Dresser says addressing school discipline disparities would help as well, so that Black students would be in a better position to graduate and aim for future job success. Mike Moen, Public News Service.
In Texas, the coronavirus pandemic and natural disasters each take a major physical toll, but studies show that they take a major toll on residents' mental health, too. A 2017 Rice University study showed that half of Houston area residents wrestled with, quote, powerful or severe emotional distress since Hurricane Harvey hit the city. How are they impacted now? Roz Brown has the story.
COVID-19 has created its own storm surge, a surge in the number of people seeking mental health treatment. That's according to the National Alliance of Mental Illness in Texas.
From March to April, NAMI Texas Executive Director Greg Hensch says they saw a 300% increase in calls from people due to anxiety, depression, difficulty sleeping, and other symptoms most said they'd never experienced before. He says most callers are age 55 or older. They're looking for resources or just someone to talk with about their anxieties.
It's definitely a lot of the isolation concern. Probably the second biggest would be uncertainty around their personal finances.
Many Texans also face another source of anxiety. In the past 10 years, state residents have been hit with 15 federally declared major disasters for storms or wildfires, six of them in the Houston area.
Experts recommend that people experiencing mental health issues try to follow a routine, get fresh air and exercise, eat well, and use clinical mental health services as needed. I'm Roz Brown.
Northeast and Mid-Atlantic states are working to cut CO2 emissions from transportation. For more on that, here's Dr. Anthony Lizowitz with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. The Mid-Atlantic and Northeast regions of the U.S. are home to major cities and sprawling road networks. All that traffic creates a lot of carbon pollution.
transportation issues are multi-state and regional by their very nature, so it really does make a lot of sense to tackle them in a regional way.
James Bradbury is with the Georgetown Climate Center. It facilitates the Transportation and Climate Initiative, a collaboration between Washington, D.C. and 12 states. To reduce transportation emissions, members of the group are developing a regional cap and invest program. It could take effect as early as 2022. When it does, it would require fuel suppliers to hold allowances, essentially permits, for the carbon pollution caused by the fuel they distribute.
And the total number of allowances would be capped and then decline over time to ensure that you actually get the emissions reductions.
The allowances will be bought and sold at auction, and the proceeds will help fund clean transportation. For example, they could be used for mass transit, bike paths, or incentives for electric vehicles. So Bradbury says the program should improve mobility while reducing carbon pollution. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, August 28th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast is Jeffrey Wade, Ray Bodwell, and Althea Billings. The producer is Ray Bodwell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Antonia Gonzalez, Mike Moen, Roz Brown, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Nat Moon.